305, Chapters 1 and 2 of Age of Innocence. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 305, Innocence is Naughty. This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. And links to all of our sponsors can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. Please visit them, as their support for the show is one of the things that keeps it free for you. Well, hello and welcome back after the hiatus, getting everything prepped for the Age of Innocence. It's been really cool. I have got lots and lots of really nifty things cooking for you, some of which I am able to roll out right now, and some of which I will be rolling out over time. But before we go any farther, I wanted to give a little explanation for new listeners. Since it's a new book, I know we have new listeners, and so here's how this works. Every Friday, I upload the next episode of Craftlit, and I also upload a sister show called Just the Books, which is at just-the-books.com. Just the Books lops off all of the crafty chat and just plays the book talk and the book. Craftlit, each episode, starts with crafty information that people send me that I think you might be interested in knowing about, which you're going to hear some of today. Sometimes it's a pattern about a pattern that I've written or a pattern that I'm working on that I think you might be interested in. Sometimes it's about things like Zentangles, because it is Craftlit and there are many kinds of crafts. Once the crafty information is out of the way, we get onto the book talk. I go in and unlock the next chapter, curate the next chapter of a book, in this case, The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. I was a high school English teacher, then I was a college teacher, now I'm home with kids, and I'm writing books like What Would Madame Defarge Knit, which is a knitting pattern book. We also have another feed, which is a premium subscription feed, and over on that feed right now we're doing Bleak House, and you can either listen as a streaming subscriber, where you listen on your phone or streaming off your computer, or you can listen as a download-only subscriber, and all of that information can be found in links in the show notes. So if you want to find out about listening to Bleak House, which is not bleak at all, it's such a misleading title. You can go look at the show notes at craftlit.com. That's all one word, C-R-A-F-T-L-I-T. You may be wondering about the title of this episode, Innocence is Naughty. And that is because there's a new podcast, the Naughty Girls Podcast. And here is a promo for them.
Naughty girls need yarn.
Hi, I'm Laura.
And I'm Jen.
And we'd like to invite you to come join us at the Naughty Girls Knitcast, where we talk about all things relevant to knit and geek cultures that strike our fancy.
You can find us on iTunes at the Naughty Girls Knitcast or at naughtygirls.wordpress.com. Stay twisty, my friends.
Knitting geeks, best kind of geeks, makes me very happy. So that was one thing I wanted to share with you. The next is that if you have Knit Companion for the iPad, yes, I am the new voice of Sammy. I couldn't tell you before, but it was very exciting. And Sally Holt is just so much fun to work with. I love working with her. So I hope that the Sammy videos are helpful. I learned a lot recording the Sammy audio, so that was kind of cool. Our winner of our last giveaway, which was, if you recall, the end of Jane Eyre, all of the month of May, I was taking comments in the show notes. Anybody who commented was up for winning a copy of Hunter Hammerson's book, The Knitter's Curiosity Cabinet, 2, Volume 2. And the winner is Puffy Griffinclaw. She left a comment, and the random number generator picked the number of comment that she had written, and therefore the book belongs to her. So I will be contacting you separately to let you know you've won and to get your address. But we have another giveaway for the month of July 2013. Friend of the show and jewelry artist Catherine Barbosa has created an exquisite Age of Innocence piece of jewelry art, and she will be giving it away to a lucky listener. Now, what I normally do over on the Craftlit site is I use a random number generator, and anyone who puts a comment into the show notes, I look at the number of days and I calculate starting from the first day. First comment, first day of that month would be number one, next comment number two, next comment number three. I will be doing the same, except I will be combining the two shows. So Craftlit first comment first day will be number one, and that will go through the end of the month of July 2013. And then once I have that number total, let's say it's 50, get 50 comments, then Just the Books first comment first day, that would be number 51. And then I would look at that total, put that information into the random number generator, and that is how I would pick a listener to win a fabulous piece of jewelry. Pictures of said jewelry can be found in the show notes for this episode and for all the episodes in July 2013. So you can take a look at it and leave a comment. The comment doesn't have to be about the jewelry. You're certainly welcome to talk about it if you'd like, but you could just talk about what's going on in our book, The Age of Innocence. And the other thing I needed to announce to you in case, well, not in case, but because this all happened while I was on hiatus, Aaron Ziegler over at ChopBard and his producer Shannon Sneeds and Aaron's mother, Judy Ziegler, all put a book out called The Shakespeare Alphabet Book. And it is awesome and beautiful. And I have actually held a copy in my hot little hands and then promptly sent it to my niece for her birthday. She just turned 2. This book is gorgeous. It is so heartfelt and so so a product of love of Shakespeare, but also a gift to those of us who love Shakespeare. You will not want to pass an opportunity like this up. I have links in the show notes for where you can get the book or how you can see pictures of it, and I hope you do go take a look and get yourself a copy. It is just lovely. And certainly you must know a child who would love a Shakespeare alphabet book. Or if you are a child at heart, you would want one for your very own. Just beautiful. Lovely, lovely, lovely. And another little nifty, lovely bit for you. Lisa Clark. Lisa Clark, who runs a website called Polka Dot Cottage, she does gorgeous work and her site is gorgeous. And I love her whole look and feel and personality. She's cool. She has a new little pattern book. It's like an ebook patterned thing. And it's for how to make a skirt really quick and dirty, how to make a skirt out of a sheet. The skirts are adorable. And her instructions are so easy to follow. Even if all you've ever been able to do is sew a straight line, this is for you. So I know, how often do I do sewing stuff? I'm very excited and I hope to do more sewing stuff because I really like what Lisa is doing and what Karen Lepage is doing as well. More about them as we continue through this book. So head over and take a look through the show notes at Lisa Clark's little skirt pattern. And all of that is really wonderful, but we have a book to get to, don't we? The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton is one of those books that I had heard of for a long time, but it is not, really not, a high school book. And I know that there are lots of high schools that taught Ethan Frome, which is another Edith Wharton book, and reading her text, I'm wondering why anyone would try and teach any of her books to high school students. It's kind of like that. Back when we did Tale of Two Cities, I mentioned that my freshman high school English teacher tried to teach Tale of Two Cities to a bunch of 14-year-olds without giving us any context or any kind of help. And it was pretty much a washout, unless I suppose some of the students were completely self-motivated or really like Dickens or something, and they probably read the book, but I was a good student and I didn't. And I'm reading The Age of Innocence over and over again, and I'm thinking, yeah, I can't figure out how I could have pulled this one off with high school students. Most of the time I can. Most of the time I can go, oh no, well, the way in would have been dot, dot, dot. So all of that is my way of saying to you this. If you listen to this show with a child or with your kids or with your high school students, you may find yourself fielding questions like, why is this interesting? Or, what does she mean by that? Because at heart, this book is about romance. And that makes it sound like a high school book, right? But it's so not, unless you have a high school student or teenager, or unless you were a high school student or teenager who had an uncanny ability to understand what mortality feels like. And I don't say that because anybody in this book dies. They don't. But the clock is ticking throughout the book. And opportunity presents itself. And as one of the lines in Into the Woods says, and it's an old saying, opportunity is not a lengthy visitor. And I think that that's something that high school students, teenagers, inherently, just from a brain development side of things, they inherently can't really grasp that. You know, that part of their brain that allows them to project into the future, to think, oh, that might not be such a great idea, jumping off a cliff or driving my car too fast or, you know, fill in the blanks. My dad likes to tell the joke that there are like three classic famous last words that men say, and the first one is, hey, watch this. And it's that teenage thing. And this is not that book. However, what this book is, and lest I make you think, oh, I should turn this off, what this book is arch and dry and funny, and at the same time, brutal and heartbreaking. And it's kind of wonderful because we have so much distance now between us and this world that Edith Wharton was writing about. And she had distance between herself and this world that she was writing about. She was writing about the world from her childhood. She was writing about 1870s New York. And for those of you who are living in the UK and listening to this book, this will be very much a period piece, the same way that a lot of books from the UK are period pieces to the rest of us. You know, we get an insight into your history. We get an insight into times and places and customs and manners that give us a shorthand when we're talking about things. Well, the interesting thing is, here's New York in 1870, and literature and art in the United States from the time of Washington Irving was first starting to be taken seriously. So you really don't have a base of American arts and letters yet. Not substantial, not deeply rooted in the culture. That means, where will cultured New Yorkers look for their culture? They will look to Europe. The comments that Edith Wharton makes about that fact throughout the book, and they happen, you know, they're scattered throughout the book, I think are really quite surprising. They're not what I had expected, but in retrospect, they make perfect sense. Because, of course, you know, Americans were a bunch of uppity colonists who got used to taking care of themselves and then couldn't understand why they were still under the rule of a distant king who wasn't listening to them at the time. But that's, you know, that uppityness that started on the Eastern Seaboard, localized in, you know, Boston and Philadelphia and Virginia, you can see these places where there were kind of hotbeds of discussion and dissent and dispute and all along the water. You would expect New York to have been part of that uppityness too, and it was sort of, but it was also Dutch. And you're going to hear a lot of Dutch names in these old names of old New York. And by old names and old New York, we are quite distinctly talking about money, old money. Now, they don't carry titles with them necessarily, and they don't carry class rank, you know, like nobility. Like if we're listening over in Bleak House, we have Lester Dedlock, baronet. We do not have that kind of a class structure in the United States, at least not one that we admit to. But within this world that Edith Wharton has built, there is quite definitely a class structure, and it is strict, and it is strong, and we will not leave that world. This is not a Dickensian novel. We will never move from a Lady Dedlock down to some pauper in the street. We won't be doing that. We will stay in our little rarefied world because our narrative stays with a man named Newland Archer. And Newland, I'm blown away by Edith Wharton writing this book from this guy's perspective. And I don't think we can really talk about why I think she did it this way until much later in the book. But she did. And she writes, not with a man's voice, it's kind of this third-person omniscient thing, but it's like with a Harry Potter book, how J.K. Rowling sticks with Harry, the narrative sticks with Harry for the most part. Same thing happens here. The narrative pretty much sticks with Newland Archer. But that will not stop Edith Wharton from making wry, dry, acerbic comments about everything that she sees. And it's one of the reasons why this recording is so marvelous, because this is Brenda Dane, who is reading to us. And Brenda can do this kind of humor where you can hear her eyebrow go up. You can hear her looking over the top of her glasses at you, waiting for you to get the joke and smile, and perhaps giggle behind your fan just a touch. But her voice is spectacular for this book. It couldn't be better. And I'm so excited to be able to bring it to you, if only for that reason. Now, often with books or authors that we haven't done before on the podcast, or even sometimes when we have done them on the podcast, I kind of front load information about the author into the opening of the book, because it sometimes really matters that you understand certain specific elements of the author's life or the author's philosophy or their family or whatever. In this case, with Edith Wharton, I think the only things you need to know are she was rich, she was part of the society that she is writing about, she grew up in the 1870s in New York, and she started writing at a very young age. So she was, her family, her family put up with her writing and all of that. However, she didn't publish this book until 1919, until after World War I, and until after she'd been living in France for a while. So this is very much a looking back book. And you will hear her later on in the book making comments about things that she simply could not have known in the 1870s. And that's because she's writing it in 1919. So there's a lot of perspective that she brings to this. But she is not a kid when she's writing this book. She has lived a life, and a life that had some pretty major disappointments in it. And so that's also part of the, it's not really a teenager book. Like Jane Eyre, any teenager can get into that if they're paying any attention. Even teenage guys can get into that. Age of Innocence would be trickier. And I'm absolutely confident that some of you who are listening read this when you were in high school and loved it. And I'm absolutely confident that some of you have teenagers at home who will read this and love it. And I really encourage you to go to the show notes and put a comment in the show notes telling us what it was about the book that got you when you were a kid, or what is it about the book that's getting your kid right now about this book. I'm fascinated to know. So one of the things to know at the outset is that the first two scenes are going to take place in the New York City Opera House. Now, as far as I know, this opera house no longer exists. I believe, and this is pulling on like 20 years ago memory, I believe this opera house is mentioned in the book The Alienist, which is a marvelous piece of kind of trashy historical fiction. It's a lot of fun. It's mostly historical fiction, heavy on the fiction, about this, you know, I'm pulling this totally out of my memory. It's just after turn of the century New York, because Teddy Roosevelt is there, but he's not president yet. So anyway, after 1900, and there are lots of places in that book that are mentioned that no longer exist in New York, but the remnants of them exist. Like there was a reservoir kind of in the middle of Midtown, that kind of thing. Doesn't exist anymore, obviously. Well, Edith Wharton is going to tell you about their opera house, and she's going to mention that they're building an opera house uptown, which is newer and more spacious and nicer. But the old money prefer the cramped kind of shabbiness of the original because it keeps the riffraff out. All the new money is going to want to go to the new opera house. But the old money, the people with, you know, class and names, they all go to the old opera house. Now, she does give them credit for one thing. The acoustics are excellent. But most of the reason why the people that we're watching go is because that's where society goes, not because the acoustics are better. In fact, you'd probably be looked at a little odd if you said, oh, but the acoustics are so much better there. They'd be like, that's so, so not the point. And so right off the bat, she's plunged us into a world that most of us do not live within, and that seems a little odd and rarefied and illogical. And that's fine, because she's our guide. She's our guide. She's going to take us through all of this. So we start to learn the rules of society by listening to her commentary and by her letting us see Newland Archer's attitudes towards all of this. And he's a little distanced, and he's a little bit of an observer himself, but not too much of an observer, because of course that would be very risky. Then you'd get bohemian, and then that would be crossing a line, and he's not going to cross that line. He's a good son of the New York gentility. Now, I often mention movie versions when we're doing a book, and there is one movie version of this book that I have seen quite a bit of. I've seen the whole movie a number of times, but I've seen it quite a bit because I used sections of it when I taught high school English, and I was trying to find a way to move students from post-Civil War America into The Great Gatsby, and I had to do it in one day because I didn't want to waste any time. And so I used movie clips, and I used lots of different movie clips, and Age of Innocence was one of those movies that I went to pull clips from. Ballroom sequence at the beginning and the opera sequence at the very beginning, which is where the book starts, were two of my favorite scenes to use because they are so detailed. And I'm bringing it up right now because I'm going to tell you this. If you get a copy of The Age of Innocence, which was directed marvelously by Martin Scorsese, watch it after each episode. I don't think it will throw anything. It follows the book so closely. I don't think they mess around with the timeline. I'll let you know. But for now, if you listen to today's podcast and get a hold of a copy of the movie and watch the first, I think it's like 10 minutes, maybe, That is the chapters that we do today. And many things will make more sense to you once you see them, because a lot of Edith Wharton's description is describing things that we don't wear anymore, like tulle tuckers. We might know what tulle is. It's that kind of netted, sheer netted fabric that you might use in a crinoline, or that you might make a kind of a shoulder wrap out of. And in fact, that's exactly what the women were doing. A tulle tucker would be a piece of tulle that you could wrap around your shoulders that was shaped. It wasn't just a piece of fabric. It had been shaped and pinned and often had beading sewn into it and stuff like that. But you would kind of tuck it. It would go around the bosom of your neckline. So it would be kind of a modesty thing. We don't really go for that anymore in our society. So you don't see a whole lot of tulle tuckers out there. You're going to hear a throwaway reference to pen wipers for clergymen. And I actually, when I was digging around online, I found a Godey's Victorian pen wipers ebook pattern book on Etsy. So I have a link to that so you can see. These were incredibly decorated things, these pen wipers. So that was kind of fun. Now you're going to hear one of the characters described as wearing an empire waist dress with a girdle, which makes no sense at all, right? Because we think of a girdle as an undergarment that would cinch in your waist and make it possible for you to wear the more fitted wasp-waisted dresses. But girdles are really anything that gird you, that go around you. And so I've linked in the show notes to a picture of, actually, I think it's Victoria, as young Victoria. Maybe not. It's Victoria, Duchess of Kent. Anyway, I need to review my history. But she's wearing an empire-waisted dress with a cincture underneath her bosom. And it's very simple, but it's very elegant. And it's not really of the time period that we're talking about, the 1870s. It comes much earlier. So it's kind of an interesting fashion for someone to be wearing. And she's wearing her hair in a Josephine look. I've also linked to a picture that shows kind of the Josephine look, tight, tight, tight curls around the forehead and a circlet of diamonds, you know, to keep it all in place. Because one must have one's diamonds, but not before 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I believe. Emily Post says it is vulgar to wear diamonds before 5 o'clock, just so you know. One of the things that I am still researching for this book is the names. If you think back to, if you listen to The Great Gatsby that we did over on the subscriber stream, and which is now available in the shop, the Just the Benefits version of the book, because Gatsby is still under copyright. One of the things that Fitzgerald does at the beginning of one of the chapters is he has this laundry list of names of people who we are supposed to know. And of course, they're all fictional. Some of them are alluding to real people. Mostly, it's just fictional names that sound rich. Well, the interesting thing about Edith Wharton's book is, of course, she did know everyone, and she was part of the society, so she couldn't possibly have used real people's names. But there are words and names that you will look at and go, gosh, that's weird, because there's a Lefferts Boulevard, and there's a Lawrence Lefferts in the book. So I'm still trying to figure out if she's being purposeful in the names for snarky reasons or purposeful in the names for other reasons. And as soon as I can find something out about that, I will let you know. But you are going to hear a laundry list of names. The nice thing is that these characters pop up over and over and over again. So you really will get to feel like you know Beaufort and Lefferts and the Chiverses and the Mingotts and the Wellands and the Archers. These will all become names that you are very familiar with and you have personalities attached to. One set of names that she uses, however, that are real are the names of the actors, actresses, and eventually ballet singers, that would be interesting, who appear in Faust and in her descriptions of the opera at In chapter 2, which we will listen to. We will listen to 1 and 2 today. The Tuileries of Louis Napoleon. This was a palace, the Tuileries Palace. It is no longer extant. It was destroyed in 1871 during the Paris Commune days. And it was big, but it also would have been popular prior to the problems in France for people to go and see and be seen. Now, the opera that they're listening to in the beginning of the book is Faust, and it is not Goethe's Faust, and it is not Marlowe's Faust. It is an opera version of Faust, and I've linked in the show notes to a summary of the opera itself, because there is a character named Marguerite who is picking daisies, and as far as I can remember, that's not in Goethe or Marlowe. It's been a long time since I read them, but I don't seem to remember that. In fact, reading the whole plot line, Mephistopheles is there and Faust is there. And the plot line eventually does become important again. So we will wind up talking about Faust further down the line. But for now, just know that Edith Wharton saw this this opera and saw it often. And so that is where this comes from. She does use it again as a device. But for now, it is a historical document for us. A couple other historical documents, they talk about men's pumps, men's patent leather oxfords, and I have linked two pictures of those from the show notes. You'll kind of get an idea of what the distinction is if you see the pictures. And in fact, the picture that I found of the pumps is the picture that of the shoes that Albert married Victoria in while wearing. So that's kind of cool. And then music, I had to find some music that was of the time. And so we will be listening to Strauss's Kaiser Waltz. And I believe Scorsese uses this in the movie too, which just makes me that much happier. But this was a piece of music that I was able to find online from a music source. And I will put a link to that in the show notes as well. So with that, I think we should listen to chapters 1 and 2 of The Age of Innocence, as read to us by Brenda Dane.
The Age of Innocence, a novel by Edith Wharton, read for LibriVox by Brenda Dane. Chapter 1. On a January evening of the early 70s, Christine Nilsson was singing in Faust at the Academy of Music in New York. Though there was already talk of the erection, in remote metropolitan distances above the 40s, of a new opera house which should compete in costliness and splendor with those of the great European capitals, the world of fashion was still content to reassemble every winter in the shabby red and gold boxes of the sociable old academy. Conservatives cherished it for being small and inconvenient, and thus keeping out the new people, whom New York was beginning to dread and yet be drawn to. And the sentimental clung to it for its historic associations, and the musical for its excellent acoustics, always so problematic a quality in halls built for the hearing of music. It was Madame Nilsson's first appearance that winter, and what the daily press had already learned to describe as an exceptionally brilliant audience had gathered to hear her, transported through the slippery, snowy streets in private brooms, in the spacious family landau, or in the humbler but more convenient brown coupe. To come to the opera in a brown coupe was almost as honorable a way of arriving as in one's own carriage, and departure by the same means had the immense advantage of enabling one, with a playful allusion to democratic principles, to scramble into the first brown conveyance in the line, instead of waiting until the cold and gin-congested nose of one's own coachman gleamed under the portico of the academy. It was one of the great livery stableman's most masterly intuitions to have discovered that Americans want to get away from amusement even more quickly than they want to get to it. When Newland Archer opened the door at the back of the club box, the curtain had just gone up on the garden scene. There was no reason why the young man should not have come earlier, for he had dined at 7, alone with his mother and sister, and had lingered afterward over a cigar in the Gothic library with glazed black walnut bookcases and finial-topped chairs, which was the only room in the house where Mrs. Archer allowed smoking. But in the first place, New York was a metropolis, and perfectly aware that in metropolises it was not the thing to arrive early at the opera. And what was or was not the thing played a part as important in Newland Archer's New York as the inscrutable totem terrors that had ruled the destinies of his forefathers thousands of years ago. The second reason for his delay was a personal one. He had dawdled over his cigar because he was, at heart, a dilettante, and thinking over a pleasure to come often gave him a subtler satisfaction than its realization. This was especially the case when the pleasure was a delicate one, as his pleasures mostly were. And on this occasion, the moment he looked forward to was so rare and exquisite in quality that, well, if he had timed his arrival in accord with the prima donna's stage manager, he could not have entered the academy at a more significant moment than just as she was singing, "He loves me, he loves me not, he loves me," and sprinkling the falling daisy petals with notes as clear as dew. She sang, of course, "Mama," and not "He loves me," since an unalterable and unquestioned law of the musical world required that the German text of French operas sung by Swedish artists should be translated into Italian for the clearer understanding of English-speaking audiences. This seemed as natural to Newland Archer as all the other conventions on which his life was molded, such as the duty of using 2 silver-backed brushes with his monogram in blue enamel to part his hair, and of never appearing in society without a flower, preferably a gardenia, in his buttonhole. "Mama, no mama," the prima donna sang, and "Mama," with a final burst of love triumphant, as she pressed the disheveled daisy to her lips and lifted her large eyes to the sophisticated countenance of the little brown Faust Capoul, who was vainly trying, in a tight purple velvet doublet and plumed cap, to look as pure and true as his artless victim. Newland Archer, leaning against the wall at the back of the club box, turned his eyes from the stage and scanned the opposite side of the house. Directly facing him was the box of old Mrs. Manson Mingott, whose monstrous obesity had long since made it impossible for her to attend the opera, but who was always represented on fashionable nights by some of the younger members of the family. On this occasion, the front of the box was filled by her daughter-in-law, Mrs. Lovell Mingott, and her daughter, Mrs. Welland. And slightly withdrawn behind these brocaded matrons sat a young girl in white, with eyes ecstatically fixed on the stage lovers. As Madame Nilsson's "Mama" trilled out above the silent house, the boxes always stopped talking during the daisy song, a warm pink mounted to the girl's cheek, mantled her brow to the roots of her fair braids, and suffused the young slope of her breast to the line where it met a modest tulle tucker, fastened with a single gardenia. She dropped her eyes to the immense bouquet of lilies of the valley on her knee, and Newland Archer saw her white-gloved fingertips touch the flowers softly. He drew a breath of satisfied vanity, and his eyes returned to the stage. No expense had been spared on the setting, which was acknowledged to be very beautiful, even by people who shared his acquaintance with the opera houses of Paris and Vienna. The foreground, to the footlights, was covered with emerald green cloth. In the middle distance, symmetrical mounds of woolly green moss, bounded by croquet hoops, formed the base of shrubs, shaped like orange trees, but studded with large pink and red roses. Gigantic pansies, considerably larger than the roses, and closely resembling the floral pen wipers made by female parishioners for fashionable clergymen, sprang from the moss beneath the rose trees. And here and there, a daisy grafted on a rose branch flowered with a luxuriance prophetic of Mr. Luther Burbank's far-off prodigies. In the center of this enchanted garden, Madame Nilsson, in white cashmere slashed with pale blue satin, a reticule dangling from a blue girdle, and large yellow braids carefully disposed on each side of her muslin chemisette, listened, with downcast eyes, to Monsieur Capoul's impassioned wooing, and affected a guileless incomprehension of his designs whenever, by word or glance, he persuasively indicated the ground floor window of the neat brick villa projecting obliquely from the right wing. The darling, thought Newland Archer, his glance flitting back to the young girl with the lilies of the valley. She doesn't even guess what it's all about. And he contemplated her absorbed young face with a thrill of possessorship, in which pride in his own masculine initiation was mingled with a tender reverence for her abysmal purity. We'll read Faust together by the Italian lakes, he thought, somewhat hazily confusing the scene of his projected honeymoon with the masterpieces of literature which it would be his manly privilege to reveal to his bride. It was only that afternoon that May Welland had let him guess that she cared, New York's consecrated phrase of maiden avowal, and already his imagination, leaping ahead of the engagement ring, the betrothal kiss, and the march from Lohengrin, pictured her at his side in some scene of old European witchery. He did not, in the least, wish the future Mrs. Newland Archer to be a simpleton. He meant her, thanks to his enlightening companionship, to develop a social tact and readiness of wit enabling her to hold her own with the most popular married women of the younger set, in which it was the recognized custom to attract masculine homage while playfully discouraging it. If he had probed to the bottom of his vanity, as he sometimes nearly did, he would have found there the wish that his wife should be as worldly wise and as eager to please as the married lady whose charms had held his fancy through 2 mildly agitated years, without, of course, any hint of the frailty which had so nearly marred that unhappy being's life and had disarranged his own plans for a whole winter. How this miracle of fire and ice was to be created, and to sustain itself in a harsh world, he had never taken the time to think out. But he was content to hold his view without analyzing it, since he knew it was that of all the carefully brushed, white-waistcoated, buttonhole-flowered gentlemen who succeeded each other in the club box, exchanged friendly greetings with him, and turned their opera glasses critically on the circle of ladies who were the product of their system. In matters intellectual and artistic, Newland Archer felt himself distinctly the superior of these chosen specimens of old New York gentility. He had probably read more, thought more, and even seen a good deal more of the world than any other man of the number. Singly, they betrayed their inferiority, but grouped together, they represented New York. And the habit of masculine solidarity made him accept their doctrine in all the issues called moral. He instinctively felt that in this respect it would be troublesome, and also rather bad form, to strike out for himself. "Well, upon my soul," exclaimed Lawrence Lefferts, turning his opera glass abruptly away from the stage. Lawrence Lefferts was, on the whole, the foremost authority on form in New York. He had probably devoted more time than anyone else to the study of this intricate and fascinating question. But study alone could not account for his complete and easy competence. One had only to look at him, from the slant of his bald forehead and the curve of his beautiful fair mustache, to the long patent leather feet at the other end of his lean and elegant person, to feel that the knowledge of form must be congenital in anyone who knew how to wear such good clothes, so carelessly, and carry such height with so much lounging grace. As a young admirer had once said of him, "If anybody can tell a fellow just when to wear a black tie with evening clothes and when not to, it's Larry Lefferts." And on the question of bumps versus patent leather Oxfords, his authority had never been disputed. "My God," he said, and silently handed his glass to old Sillerton Jackson. Newland Archer, following Lefferts' glance, saw with surprise that his exclamation had been occasioned by the entry of a new figure into old Mrs. Mingott's box. It was that of a slim young woman, a little less tall than May Welland, with brown hair growing in close curls about her temples and held in place by a narrow band of diamonds. The suggestion of this headdress, which gave her what was then called a Josephine look, was carried out in the cut of the dark blue velvet gown, rather theatrically caught up under her bosom by a girdle with a large, old-fashioned clasp. The wearer of this unusual dress, who seemed quite unconscious of the attention it was attracting, stood a moment in the center of the box, discussing with Mrs. Welland the propriety of taking the latter's place in the front right-hand corner. Then she yielded, with a slight smile, and seated herself in line with Mrs. Welland's sister-in-law, Mrs. Lovell Mingott, who was installed in the opposite corner. Mr. Sillerton Jackson had returned the opera glass to Lawrence Lefferts. The whole of the club turned instinctively, waiting to hear what the old man had to say, for old Mr. Jackson was as great an authority on family as Lawrence Lefferts was on form. He knew all the ramifications of New York's cousinships and could not only elucidate such complicated questions as that of the connection between the Mingotts, through the Thorleys, with the Dallases of South Carolina, and that of the relationship of the elder branch of the Philadelphia Thorleys to the Albany Chiverses, on no account to be confused with the Manson Chiverses of University Place, but could also enumerate the leading characteristics of each family, as, for instance, the fabulous stinginess of the younger lines of Leffertses, the Long Island ones, or the fatal tendency of the Rushworths to make foolish matches, or the insanity recurring in every second generation of the Albany Chiverses, with whom their New York cousins had always refused to intermarry, with the disastrous exception of poor Medora Manson, who, as everybody knew, but then, her mother was a Rushworth. In addition to this forest of family trees, Mr. Sillerton Jackson carried between his narrow, hollow temples and under his soft thatch of silver hair a register of most of the scandals and mysteries that had smoldered under the unruffled surface of New York society within the last 50 years. So far, indeed, did his information extend, and so acutely retentive was his memory, that he was supposed to be the only man who could have told you who Julius Beaufort, the banker, really was, and what had become of handsome Bob Spicer, old Mrs. Manson Mingott's father, who had disappeared so mysteriously with a large sum of trust money, less than a year after his marriage, on the very day that a beautiful Spanish dancer, who had been delighting thronged audiences in the opera house on the Battery, had taken the ship for Cuba. But these mysteries, and many others, were closely locked in Mr. Jackson's breast, for not only did his keen sense of honor forbid his repeating anything privately imparted, but he was fully aware that his reputation for discretion increased his opportunities of finding out what he wanted to know. The club box, therefore, waited in visible suspense while Mr. Sillerton Jackson handed back Lawrence Lefferts' opera glass. For a moment he silently scrutinized the attentive group out of his filmy blue eyes overhung by old-veined lids. Then he gave his mustache a thoughtful twist and said simply, "I didn't think the Mingotts would have tried it on." End of chapter 1. Chapter 2. Newland Archer, during this brief episode, had been thrown into a state of embarrassment. It was annoying that the box, which was thus attracting the undivided attention of masculine New York, should be that in which his betrothed was seated between her mother and aunt. And for a moment he could not identify the lady in the Empire dress, nor imagine why her presence created such excitement among the initiated. Then light dawned on him, and with it came a momentary rush of indignation. No, indeed. No one would have thought the Mingotts would have tried it on. But they had. They undoubtedly had. For the low-toned comments behind him left no doubt in Archer's mind that the young woman was May Welland's cousin, the cousin always referred to in the family as poor Ellen Olenska. Archer knew that she had suddenly arrived from Europe a day or two previously. He had even heard from Miss Welland, not disapprovingly, that she had been to see poor Ellen, who was staying with old Mrs. Mingott. Archer entirely approved of family solidarity, and one of the qualities he most admired in the Mingotts was their resolute championship of the few black sheep that their blameless stock had produced. There was nothing mean or ungenerous in the young man's heart, and he was glad that his future wife should not be restrained by false prudery from being kind, in private, to her unhappy cousin. But to receive Countess Olenska in the family circle was a different thing from producing her in public, at the opera of all places, and in the very box with the young girl whose engagement to him, Newland Archer, was to be announced within a few weeks. No, he felt as old Sillerton Jackson felt. He did not think the Mingotts would have tried it on. He knew, of course, that whatever man dared, within Fifth Avenue's limits, that old Mrs. Manson Mingott, the matriarch of the line, would dare. He had always admired the high and mighty old lady who, in spite of having been only Catherine Spicer of Staten Island, with a father mysteriously discredited, and neither money nor position enough to make people forget it, had allied herself with the head of the wealthy Mingott line, married two of her daughters to foreigners, an Italian marquis and an English banker, and put the crowning touch to her audacities by building a large house of pale cream-colored stone when brown sandstone seemed as much the only wear as a frock coat in the afternoon, in an inaccessible wilderness near the Central Park. Old Mrs. Mingott's foreign daughters had become a legend. They never came back to see their mother, and the latter being, like many persons of active mind and dominating will, sedentary and corpulent in her habit, had philosophically remained at home. But the cream-colored house, supposed to be modeled on the private hotels of the Parisian aristocracy, was there as a visible proof of her moral courage, and she throned in it, among pre-revolutionary furniture and souvenirs of the Tuileries of Louis Napoleon, where she had shone in her middle age, as placidly as if there were nothing peculiar in living above 34th Street, or in having French windows that opened like doors, instead of sashes that pushed up. Everyone, including Mr. Sillerton Jackson, was agreed that old Catherine had never had beauty, a gift which, in the eyes of New York, justified every success and excused a certain number of failings. Unkind people said that, like her imperial namesake, she had won her way to success by strength of will and hardness of heart and a kind of haughty effrontery that was somehow justified by the extreme decency and dignity of her private life. Mr. Manson Mingott had died when she was only 28 and had tied up the money with an additional caution born of the general distrust of the Spicers. But his bold young widow went her way fearlessly, mingled freely in foreign society, married her daughters in heaven knew what corrupt and fashionable circles, hobnobbed with dukes and ambassadors, associated familiarly with papists, entertained opera singers and was the intimate friend of Madame Taglioni, and all the while, as Sillerton Jackson was the first to proclaim, there had never been a breath on her reputation. The only respect, he always added, in which she differed from the earlier Catherine. Mrs. Manson Mingott had long since succeeded in untying her husband's fortune and had lived in affluence for half a century. But memories of her early straits had made her excessively thrifty, and though when she bought a dress or a piece of furniture, she took care that it should be of the best, she could not bring herself to spend much on the transient pleasures of the table. Therefore, for totally different reasons, her food was as poor as Mrs. Archer's, and her wines did nothing to redeem it. Her relatives considered that the penury of her table discredited the Mingott name, which had always been associated with good living. But people continued to come to her in spite of the made dishes and flat champagne, and in reply to the remonstrances of her son Lovell, who tried to retrieve the family credit by having the best chef in New York, she used to say laughingly, "What's the use of two good cooks in one family, now that I've married the girls and can't eat sauces?" Newland Archer, as he mused on these things, had once more turned his eyes towards the Mingott box. He saw that Mrs. Welland and her sister-in-law were facing their semicircle of critics with a Mingottian aplomb which old Catherine had inculcated in all her tribe, and that only May Welland betrayed, by a heightened color, perhaps due to the knowledge that he was watching her, a sense of the gravity of the situation. As for the cause of the commotion, she sat gracefully in her corner of the box, her eyes fixed on the stage and revealing, as she leaned forward, a little more shoulder and bosom than New York was accustomed to seeing, at least in ladies who had reasons for wishing to pass unnoticed. Few things seemed to Newland Archer more awful than an offense against taste, that far-off divinity of whom form was the mere visible representative and vicegerent. Madame Olenska's pale and serious face appealed to his fancy as suited to the occasion and to her unhappy situation. But the way her dress, which had no tucker, sloped away from her thin shoulders, shocked and troubled him. He hated to think of May Welland being exposed to the influence of a young woman so careless to the dictates of taste. "After all," he heard one of the younger men begin behind him. Everybody talked through the Mephistopheles and Martha scenes. "After all, just what happened?" Well, she left him. Nobody attempts to deny that. "He's an awful brute, isn't he?" continued the young inquirer, a candid Thorley, who was evidently preparing to enter the lists as the ladies' champion. "The very worst. I knew him at Nice," said Lawrence Lefferts with authority. "A half-paralyzed, white, sneering fellow, rather handsome head, but eyes with a lot of lashes. Well, I'll tell you the sort. When he wasn't with women, he was collecting china. Paying any price for both, I understand." There was a general laugh, and the young champion said, Well, then she bolted with his secretary." "Oh, I see." The champion's face fell. "It didn't last long, though. I heard of her a few months later, living alone in Venice. I believe Lovell Mingott went out to get her. He said she was desperately unhappy. That's all right, but this parading her at the opera is another thing." "Perhaps," young Thorley hazarded, "she's too unhappy to be left at home." This was greeted with an irreverent laugh, and the youth blushed deeply and tried to look as if he had meant to insinuate what knowing people called a double entendre. "Well, it's queer to have brought Miss Welland anyhow," someone said in a low tone, with a side glance at Archer. "Oh, that's part of the campaign. Granny's orders, no doubt," Lefferts laughed. "When the old lady does a thing, she does it thoroughly." The act was ending, and there was a general stir in the box. Suddenly, Newland Archer felt himself impelled to decisive action. The desire to be the first man to enter Mrs. Mingott's box, to proclaim to the waiting world his engagement to May Welland, and to see her through whatever difficulties her cousin's anomalous situation might involve her in. This impulse had abruptly overruled all scruples and hesitations, and sent him hurrying through the red corridors to the farther side of the house. As he entered the box, his eyes met Miss Welland's, and he saw that she had instantly understood his motive, though the family dignity which both considered so high a virtue would not permit her to tell him so. The persons of their world lived in an atmosphere of faint implications and pale delicacies, and the fact that he and she understood each other without a word seemed to the young man to bring them nearer than any explanation would have done. Her eyes said, "You see why Mama brought me." And his answered, "I would not for the world have had you stay away." "You know my niece, Countess Olenska?" Mrs. Welland inquired as she shook hands with her future son-in-law. Archer bowed without extending his hand, as was the custom on being introduced to a lady. And Ellen Olenska bent her head slightly, keeping her own pale-gloved hands clasped on her huge fan of eagle feathers. Having greeted Mrs. Lovell Mingott, a large blonde lady in creaking satin, he sat down beside his betrothed and said in a low voice, "I hope you've told Madame Olenska that we're engaged. I want everybody to know. I want you to let me announce it this evening at the ball." Miss Welland's face grew rosy as the dawn, and she looked at him with radiant eyes. "If you can persuade Mama," she said. "But why should we change what is already settled? He made no answer, but that which his eyes returned, and she added, still more confidently smiling, "Tell my cousin yourself, I give you leave. She says she used to play with you when you were children." She made way for him by pushing back her chair, and promptly, and a little ostentatiously, with a desire that the whole house should see what he was doing, Archer seated himself at the Countess Olenska's side. "We did used to play together, didn't we?" she asked, turning her grave eyes to his. "You were a horrid boy and kissed me once behind a door, but it was your cousin, Vandy Newland, who never looked at me, that I was in love with." Her glance swept the horseshoe curve of boxes. "Ah, how this brings it all back to me. I see everybody here in knickerbockers and pantalettes," she said, with her trailing, slightly foreign accent, her eyes returning to his face. Agreeable as their expression was, the young man was shocked that they should reflect so unseemly a picture of the august tribunal before which, at that very moment, her case was being tried. Nothing could be in worse taste than misplaced flippancy, and he answered somewhat stiffly, "Yes, you have been away a very long time." "Oh, centuries and centuries, so long," she said, "that I'm sure I'm dead and buried, and this dear old place is heaven." Which, for reasons he could not define, struck Newland Archer as an even more disrespectful way of describing New York society. End of chapter 2.
And so you can already see how Edith Wharton is setting us up. She's got people like Mrs. Manson Mangut, who have somehow managed to be, and not irreverent because they're part of society, but willing to go a little bit against the grain. And of course, she's able to do this because in so many other ways, she is absolutely following the laws and rules that dictate how society is supposed to behave. The little joke that was in there was about Catherine Mingott and Catherine the Great, and that she had gotten her success by strength of will and hardness of heart and a kind of haughty effrontery that was somehow justified by the extreme decency and dignity of her private life. And so Sillerton Jackson makes the comment that her private life, her absolutely non-scandalous private life, was the only way that she differed from Catherine the Great, because as we know, Catherine the Great had quite different appetites, or at least wide-ranging ones, and it was scandalous. Scandalous, I tell you. So you've got Mrs. Manson Mingott, who can tread the line between society and this kind of bohemian thing. You know, she's friends with Italian ballerinas and Catholics even, right? And then you've got her, she's related to May Welland. And as far as we can tell, nobody is going to be more proper, more dignified, more correct than May Welland and Newland Archer. But see, we get to see inside Newland a little bit, and we can see that there's a piece of him that appreciates the kind of bohemian side. And perhaps he thinks he's a little more educated or a little more cultured than the people around him because he is able to see this other side and not disparage it out of hand. And so we're setting up these dualities. And just like with A Tale of Two Cities, where you have A Tale of Two Cities, and it's very much duality. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Here we have a different kind of duality being set up. And I would go so far as to say a more subtle one, because I think the Age of Innocence is, at its heart, a beautiful, subtle book. And Edith Wharton's writing is just lovely. I mean, the way she figures out how, in a very small number of words, it is a very spare piece of writing, in a very small number of words to convey this arch humor. I mean, it goes directly back to that, Pascal, the Pascal joke. I'm sorry this letter is so long. I didn't have enough time to make it brief. You know, it takes so much time to distill language down to this. And it's interesting that it's written in 1919 because, of course, were it written earlier, it would be far more flowery and have too many notes, like the Emperor in Amadeus, too many notes. But here, because it's 1919, it's the beginning of the modern period. It's when you start to get Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Henry James and all of these people. And she's friends with Henry James, and I think she knew the Fitzgeralds. You have this influence of the time she's living in, and of course she's in France when she's writing this, and you have it working backwards through time, looking with this kind of microscopic vision, as well as this very careful precision with her language. And so those are our first two chapters. And now we know our people, and we kind of know maybe what a conflict is going to be. We definitely know we have two different sides of things. We have the restrained, restricted, old moneyed rules. And we have on the fringe people who are pushing at the boundaries a little bit. One of the things Scorsese does that I was able to point out to the children when I was teaching high school that I think he does so marvelously is while we are very used to seeing women restrained by fashion, we understand corsets, we see the whalebone, if we've been in shows that were period pieces, we know what it's like to be put into one of those bloody corsets. However, one of the things that I think he does a lovely job of in the movie is you see how many layers and how restricted the men are as well. How many layers of clothing, all of the dancing gloves, all of the things that they are expected and required to do, all of the rituals that they all must go through, men and women. Nobody wins in this world. Nobody has an easy time in this world. At the same time, those kind of manners and restrictions that are placed on you are supposed to give you some kind of freedom. You always know how to behave. You never have to worry about what to do or what to say because it has been dictated for you. And in some ways, that's very freeing, but not many ways. So that is what we're going to hear more about next week when we do Chapter 3 of The Age of Innocence. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you come back next week to hear even more. Oh, and please check the show notes for what has been happening in Australia. Holy cow, knitting has created a kerfuffle in the government. Have a great one. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, just-the-books.com, or via our Android or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Just the Books and Craftlit are made possible by the support of our listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. Just the Books and Craftlit are produced by Penny Shima Glantz and Elizabeth Green Musselman and Heather Wardover. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.